Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Paula Kamen, who reads from and discusses her new book, Finding Iris Chang, Friendship, Ambition, and the Loss of an Extraordinary Mind, published by DeCapo. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. And thank you for coming out on this really, really cold night. Although, from Chicago, this is nothing compared to Chicago. Tonight, we want to welcome Paula Kamen and with her new book. She's, I think you probably all know, playwright, journalist, lecturer, has a great website. I love the website with lots of useful information and very interesting. And you can try and keep up with her, which to me looks like would be a challenge. So this is quite an important book, I think, that she's written, and about her friend. And I imagine I'm eager to hear what she has to say about the process that she went through, to write about a friend and someone who's made such a difference in the world with her work, in the brief years that she was here. So welcome, Paula. Okay.
Thank you. I first wanted to ask the audience if people were familiar with who Iris Chang was. This is basically a memoir about my friendship with her and about all of her many accomplishments. But just to sum it up, she was probably best known for her bestseller that came out 10 years ago, that was The Rape of Nanking. And it was a very important book because it wasn't only just about these atrocities that took place in Nanking about 70 years ago in World War II. It was also very symbolic to the Asian community about atrocities that the Japanese committed in general throughout Asia in World War II that often really weren't fully investigated. It's a very complicated relationship that we have with Japan. It's one of our major allies, and a lot of Asian Americans didn't think that all the atrocities that they were committed got a proper airing or there was enough of an apology. And how I started to write about Iris, I was a friend of hers from college, and when she committed suicide in November of 04, I wrote a eulogy about her, and that was published in Salon.com. And the response to that was just overwhelming. I probably got more of a response to that than almost anything else I'd ever written, that I saw just how symbolic she was, her book was, and how personally, people took her death, that she was symbolic to people as a working mother, as someone with depression, as an activist for social justice, as someone questioning a major government, as an Asian American, questioning authority, and the list just went on. And Iris was also very symbolic to me, that she was always a huge symbol of what it meant to be successful. And this is why her suicide seemed especially vexing, and why so many people who wrote me these emails from the Salon article, they were also confused, just like I was, how this could happen. Because Iris was really one of the most envied and enviable people I've ever met, that every time I introduced her to a friend of mine, their self-esteem would immediately plunge because they would compare themselves to her. And of course, it was impossible, that she just seemed to be utterly perfect. She was rich and famous. She was beautiful. She had a nice husband, a 2-year-old son. She was very close to her parents, lots of friends. She even had this element of glamour that Hillary Clinton invited her to the White House for a private meeting. This is just one thing that she would talk about just in our conversations, or about how the Clintons invited her to one of their Renaissance weekends in Hilton Head, and how she spent the weekend there socializing with celebrities and other best-selling authors, movie stars, and everything just seemed to be so perfect. And I really didn't know her as a depressive person, that if anything, she was incredibly upbeat, that if I would have have a problem, that she'd always just come right back at me with a list of bulleted points of things I should do. You know, that she was not the type to just wallow in depression. You know, that there was always action to be taken, you know, to conquer any problem. And, I mean, it was so mysterious when she died that a lot of people even thought that she was murdered, because it just seemed so sudden. And she was questioning, you know, the Japanese government, and also it turned out that she really was a thorn in the side of the U.S. government, that she was trying to get U.S. GIs who had been imprisoned in World War II by the Japanese to be able to sue Japanese corporations. And from the point of view of the State Department, that would have jeopardized our entire relationship with Japan, which is one of our major allies, you know, and one of our only friends, you know, that's left. So it really did seem, you know, that there was some legitimacy, you know, to some of these theories, and the rumors just multiplied and multiplied over the internet, and I saw a need, you know, to really connect the dots about what happened to her, that she was such a major public figure. There's even a statue of her, a life-size bronze statue of her that stands in Nanjing, and that's the modern term for Nanking, which then was the capital of China before the communists took over. Like I said, there was such a hunger from so many people who so strongly identified with her to really know more about what happened. I also saw a need to clear up a lot of misunderstandings about bipolar disorder, which is what she was diagnosed with in the last few weeks of her life, that often it can look different in an Asian population, that this is speaking in very general terms, but among Asians there's a narrower range of acceptable behavior, and this is even in the manic stage. And so it's unlikely that you'll see an Asian person who's in the manic stage act out as visibly and obviously as a white person, and that often isn't that well known. And I think with Iris, there's probably a factor. And then I saw a need to cover this because when she first died, the only reason that people could think of was about that the dark topics that she was covering, that possibly that had driven her over the edge. And I saw a need to, as a journalist, to look at how we can cover dark topics in the long term, but still hang on to our mental health and find a way to do it while we're supported, and see it as a process, as something to protect ourselves from. That I wanted to encourage people to still write about dark topics. We need people to cover all these terrible things, you know, that go on in society. But there also needs to be a lot more conversation about protecting ourselves too. That I was afraid that a message that a lot of people did get from her death was that it was really dangerous to cover dark topics, and you should just avoid that and not fall into the same trap, you know, of being an activist that she had. But there are ways, you know, to go about it without harm. And actually, in the book, I talked about my own fears of exploring this very dark topic of my friend's suicide, but then about how ultimately it helped me to come to terms in making it seem less mysterious. And I did get good support and I was conscious of the heaviness of the material when I was doing it, and I didn't just see it as nothing. Okay, this book, it's sort of a strange genre. It crosses different formats. On one hand, it's a memoir of our friendship. It's a biography of Iris. It's an investigation of what happened to her, and to follow her own MO, I also used a lot of primary sources and went to archives. That Iris's greatest joy in life, actually, which she always talked about, was going to archives and unearthing letters and documents and newspaper articles, you know, and just piecing together what had happened in the past. And so in turn, I followed a similar process. That it turned out that Iris had donated hundreds of boxes of her research papers to three different university archives. And a lot of that she gave just a few weeks before her death. And that actually shows just how premeditated that was. And it was sort of like she had left me a whole trail of clues that I was able to go see and find out more about her pressures, her inner life. And I also used the primary sources of emails that she had sent me over the years of some very eloquent letters too, and that made her, and that helped, you know, to convey a more intimate voice to the reader, and make her seem more human, which was a big goal of the book, to see her beyond just a symbol or a superhuman robot, which a lot of us thought that she was. Yeah, I'm going to read a beginning section of the book, and this gives you a good idea of who she was and how she often actually riled people up a lot, that she wasn't always so popular in college, and I'll tell you why that was. Let's see. My friendship with Iris Chang both started and ended with a single phone call from her, 17 years apart. In 1987, when we were both juniors in college, she was seriously considering switching her major from math and computer science to journalism. She had gotten my name from a roommate of mine who had been in one of her computer classes and called me for advice about taking this seemingly more risky and less traditional path. An issue was that she thought her parents, who were science professors at our university, had expected her to go into their field. Even just from the sound of her voice, I felt her passion for journalism and said, "Of course, if that's what you love, go for it." Then for about an hour, she drilled me unrelentingly with countless questions on what to expect from the journalism major and about every possible aspect of my years of work on the college paper and outside freelancing. When I got off the phone, I commented to my roommate about how exhausted I was from the conversation. Iris hadn't even stopped to ask if I had to go or if I had that much time to talk with her. Shortly after, I regretted giving Iris any encouragement to change her major. We soon became rivals, or rather, she became my rival. I doubt that she even stopped to think of anyone really as her rival, because that would have just slowed her down. Iris immediately started, in seemingly systematic fashion, to frustrate all my major life ambitions. It seemed that her mission was not only to be a successful journalism student, but to be nothing short of the most successful journalist of our generation. I applied for what was considered a path-paving summer internship at a magazine in New York City, which accepted only one student per college. She got the job. I later interviewed for an internship at the Chicago Tribune. When I called back a week later, as instructed, the interviewer told me, "You were close, but it went to someone else from the University of Illinois. You may know her." So I was not alone in eating Iris's dust. Others on our college paper, The Daily Illini, openly shared my frustrations. One editor told me how Iris approached her on one of her first days on the paper during our junior year and asked simply, without any small talk or polite conversation, "How do I get your job?" Another editor, Riley, said she was jealous that Iris had thought to call the Chicago Tribune and the New York Times to become a stringer from our school. She explained that she personally would have only made that move in response to some kind of overt offer or official job posting. She and her friends, who had humorously nicknamed Iris "Fucking Iris Chang," could only watch helplessly as Iris's story started to run in front sections of both those national papers. And they kept appearing over the months. Iris's New York Times editor even told her to stop because they were getting a disproportionate amount of coverage about the goings-on at the U of I. Then after we graduated, my attitude toward her shifted again. She called me to meet up in Chicago where she was working, and I thought about her more rationally. At that point, I made a conscious decision not to hate Iris Chang. With some distance from school, things were clearer. Any moron could see that she wasn't just getting by on her good looks. She was obviously very talented and could teach me something. As the features editor of our college paper senior year, I had edited her articles, or actually never edited them, because they always came in perfect. The facts, grammar, punctuation, gerunds, everything. In retrospect, I was still marveling at a lucid story she had written about recent breakthroughs in a very complicated area of artificial intelligence. During that meeting with her in Chicago, I was immediately sorry to see that the grueling hours at her new job at the Associated Press were wearing her down. In college, she had been a steamroller of energy, but now she was frail and told me that her hair was coming out. I saw then for the first time just how hard she worked, how she put a piece of herself into every story she covered. We soon moved to lighter topics. She was happy about planning her upcoming wedding. She asked me about how I was getting along. At that time, in the middle of a recession, I was fruitlessly applying for work at local newspapers that wouldn't even take the time to read my resume. So I was starting to freelance. I told her of an op-ed I had written that I would try to get published. She immediately suggested that I send it to the New York Times. I thought she was joking. I didn't have such pretensions. I thought that perhaps some local alternative paper might want it. But lo and behold, I took her advice and the piece was accepted. And a year later, on perhaps the slowest news day in history, the Times published it. My luck was changing. Not long before, I'd signed a book contract on a similar topic to that op-ed piece. I had a revelation, so that was the IRIS code. I had finally cracked it, and it was so simple. Think big, very big, almost to the point of being naive. And I'm going to skip a little bit, and I talk about the start of her career then in publishing, that she published her first book in 1995, and that was called. The Thread of the Silkworm. And for that book, she literally had to know rocket science, that it was about a rocket scientist, a Chinese American, who was blacklisted during the McCarthy years and sent back to China. And then in China, he proceeded to start the Chinese missile program. So there was a lot of irony there, that a lot of the paranoia of the McCarthy years led to a lot of real danger, you know, that wouldn't have existed earlier. And in that book, it was very useful for her to learn research techniques. And so when she did The Rape of Nanking, she even took less time to do that. And that involved, well, here, I'll tell you what that involved. In China, World War II atrocities have long been a national nightmare, and they have received attention from historians and academics over the years. But it took Iris's energy, will, and engaging writing style to make the scope of the Nanking Massacre come alive to a popular audience in the West. Her main contribution was her sense of outrage over Japanese war crimes, which tapped into what so many others of Asian descent were already feeling. She had also made a major historical discovery, the hidden diary of John Rabe, a, quote, good Nazi living in Nanking at the time, which chronicled the atrocities in China in new detail and with new authority. And this showed one of her greatest skills, is she was able to keep digging and digging and find what other people had not been able to find, that she was doing research about the Westerners in Nanking. And there's actually a new documentary called Nanking that's just out this month about it. That there was a group of a very brave Westerners, and they actually started a quote unquote safety zone. They made this up to shelter Nanking citizens, and one of the major ones was this guy John Rabe, who actually was in the Nazi Party, but he still worked relentlessly even under the most perilous circumstances, you know, to save all these citizens of Nanking. And Iris saw that the other Western heroes, they all had diaries, that there was a woman missionary, Minnie Vitron, and her diary is at Yale Divinity School, and the other Westerners all had journals. So she thought that this guy must have had one too. And so she tracked down his granddaughter in Berlin, and she went up to the attic, and sure enough, there was a box of thousands of pages of many, many journals. It wasn't just one little diary. It was like a whole archive, basically, and it documented the rape of Nanking just with incredible accuracy and detail, and it was actually a very credible source because he was a Nazi and an ally of the Japanese. And so he really didn't have an incentive to exaggerate, you know, the atrocities. And after that happened, she called me up and she was on Nightline talking about it. There was on the New York Times on page two, there was a whole press conference that was called with reporters from all over the world because it was such a major historical discovery. From her letters, I knew how hard Iris had worked on that book. On her own, she had traveled through China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan to interview survivors. She spent months researching at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and reading records from Naval Intelligence and the State Department. She tracked down many diaries and letters from those on the scene and pored over source materials in four languages. An interview in 2001, the late historian Stephen Ambrose described Iris as, quote, maybe the best young historian we've got, because she understands that to communicate history, you've got to tell the story in an interesting way. Iris was genuinely shocked by the atrocities she had exposed and reacted with a pure, honest rage, like someone seeing evil for the very first time. She couldn't understand the possibility of knowing about such things and not writing about them. Part of the power of her interviewing was that she had few filters, defense mechanisms to block out disturbing things that were said to her. I suspect that she didn't even know that people came with filters. Iris also seemed to enjoy her success, which came completely naturally to her. After the publication of The Rape of Nanking and all the resulting new demands on her, our emails became shorter and less frequent, but we still managed to talk by phone from time to time. She called me to watch her on Nightline, read her interview in the New York Times, and see her on the cover of Reader's Digest. Her life seemed to get more glamorous and enviable by the day, with reports of Hollywood meetings with filmmakers such as Oliver Stone and Steven Spielberg, who were batting about names like Jeremy Irons playing John Rabe and Emma Thompson playing one of the other ill-fated Western heroes in Nanking that she had written about, American missionary Minnie Vatron. In the months that followed, Iris continued to make headlines. A career-defining moment was her jaw-droppingly ballsy confrontation with a top Japanese official on national television, PBS's McNeil Lair News Hour, on December 1st, 1998. For the Asian American community, it was very notable to see a person of Chinese descent so forcefully challenge a high-ranking Japanese official. This was also startling because of traditional Japanese culture, which strongly avoids direct confrontation, and especially in public. And this guy, the ambassador, he was Iris's arch nemesis, that he had actually called an entire press conference in Tokyo just to denounce her a few months or in the spring before. So that actually shows the kind of pressures that she was also under, that how many of us actually get a whole press conference called to denounce us personally, you know. But then she had planned out that she was going to challenge him to a debate. And right there on national television, she asked him to apologize for the rape of Nanking. And he was flabbergasted. And I got a transcript of it, and I printed some of it in the book. And at the end, as credits are rolling, he's just like, one more thing, you know, and caught totally off guard. Then I go on and say, I can sympathize somewhat with the ambassador's frustration. Iris's relentless questioning also had often overwhelmed me. While talking with Iris usually energized me, I have to admit I needed to be prepared. I would usually wait for days to call her back because I knew a conversation with her would require a minimum of 2 to 3 hours. Despite the typical work-related conflicts that we both dished about, Iris often reminded me how lucky we were to be authors, to be able to spend our days writing about what most interests us. Quote, always remember how privileged you are, she told me, when I related my regular doubts as to whether my life course was one of pure folly. At that time, I also gradually accepted with appreciation that she was my rival. I came to see rivals are good. We need rivals. They raise the bar for us to make us aspire to levels we would never have even thought of earlier. In being my rival, she was a sort of mentor. I'm just going to skip and read a few paragraphs here. By that time, I was definitely a firm convert to the Iris Code, and I spread the gospel. When I occasionally spoke at universities and then was a guest at writing classes, I lectured students to, quote, Iris Chang it. She had become a verb to me, an action verb. Think big, I told them. That's half the battle. What do you have to lose? If someone turns you down, they turn you down. So what? And then you just move on. Get a sense of entitlement, will you? It doesn't matter if you're in the Midwest or at a public school. Decide what you want and go get it, to the point of being naive. Your voice is not your voice. It's the voice of your generation. Just Iris Chang it, I explained, almost taking on her passionate tone as I spoke. So on that note, I'm going to thank you for coming tonight.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on December 11th, 2007.